Well, I'm so glad to see all of you, especially on such a beautiful day in here. It's really an honor to be here. I've always found my home really among Unitarian Universalist congregations and communities, and really with our struggle for justice, but also from kind of a spiritual place to the interconnection of struggles for change in our world. And so I think I'm going to use three centering questions. I don't have a huge amount of time, but then I want to open it up to kind of where all of you would want to talk and take it. So first I'll start. So I grew up in a family here in Madison, Wisconsin, and I grew up in a lesbian parented family. And kind of from that experience of being marked outside, right, and that experience of facing discrimination, facing prejudice, facing hate in many ways, I also felt how powerful it was to share personal stories, and how powerful it was once people actually saw my family, right? And once people actually saw me, we weren't quite as scary. and our stories and our voices and our faces humanized what it meant to be gay and lesbian. But also with that and being marked outside, I was always drawn to all different struggles for justice. And kind of the struggle my parents had to go through even to exist, to even have me, to live life honestly and openly, but also the struggles for racial justice in our community, the struggles for economic justice. My parents were always involved in many different issues, eco-justice, and so I kind of came of age in those movements. And for me, I've always been drawn to issues in our world that we don't see. So why don't we see, for example, in these issues, why don't we see Palestinian people? Why don't we hear about Mexican migrants? Why aren't these stories that are on our news? Why are there masks and invisibility about these things? And I came to it when I was in high school. My ninth grade, so my freshman year in high school, is when September 11th happened. And so obviously, huge time, right? And huge, huge silencing. I mean, as I'm sure all of you remember, and it's still happening, but silencing of dissent, silencing of debate, silencing of conversation. But also, I think, rising Islamophobia, rising fear of Arabs, rising fear of Muslims, rising kind of this rhetoric of there is an other over here that we can't see, you know, that we'll need to make someone other to go to war, right? So as that was happening, I was working in my high school and doing lots of education work and lots of, you know, political activism and this kind of stuff. But over here, I always really wanted to be doing art. And so the thing for me was, in doing activism, I actually had given up these places that I came alive, these places even spiritually that I felt invigorated and excited about. And so actually Proud Theater, as you mentioned, which is a group that I co-founded and worked on with Callan Hardy, who's an activist in the community, was a place that it started for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered youth and lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender families and allies to kind of come together and through our stories and through our voices try to create theater that came right out of that, try to create original work that spoke to our experience but also could be social justice, right? Could not only work in educating people, but even the process empower ourselves in a lot of ways, in leadership roles, in seeing social change not just as kind of a picket in the street or organizing, but also as the process of creating art. So I wanted to keep bringing these different areas together. But anyways, as I went into college and started studying, I became so interested in these border areas. So border areas between identities, border areas on the U.S.-Mexico border, border areas in Israel and Palestine. And for me, growing up in progressive Madison, felt like we can talk about all kinds of issues, but the issues that always people seem to have fear around talking about was really Israel and Palestine. And sometimes there was this silence. It was like, oh, we can critique everything, but not that. You know, we don't go there. That will divide us. That will split us. And, of course, when I hear that as a person, I'm like, oh, I must go there. I must see what that all is about, right? And I thought of myself as an American, as a white person, as a person that has the privilege of being in college and being alive as a human being at this time in our history. Part of I felt my responsibility to see what my government was doing, to see what our tax dollars are funding. This isn't actually something on another side of the world. This is something right here that we're supporting, that not only the processes of racializing someone, of making someone other, that happen, I think, all the time, even inside ourselves, but, I mean, literally, these are our tanks. This is our money building walls. So last year at this time, I spent the amazing opportunity of spending, so this is kind of, this is the background of what drew me to these issues, if that makes sense. And I had the amazing opportunity of spending an entire semester, so 3 months, in the West Bank in occupied Palestinian territories. And my work, part of my work in college has been working with theater, right? So I finally put it together, theater, and social justice and anti-oppression work, but also how theater is being used by different kind of social movements and different organizations as resistance itself. So resistance to occupation, resistance to racism, resistance to violence, resistance to kind of economic oppression, but also as a movement for sharing voice, a movement for cultural expression, a movement also for healing and unburdening from trauma. And so the work I was doing in the West Bank, I was working in Palestinian refugee camps throughout in, so I don't know, I wish I had some visuals here for you today, but if you think of where Israel is and there's the West Bank and then there's Gaza, the occupied territories. And so I worked throughout the West Bank in three different cities and refugee camps. One of them, for example, 28,000 people living in 1/4 of a square kilometer of space. So you think of, I mean, this is like intense, intense, high density populations, people who are experiencing every night incursions from the armies. That means tanks come in. So remember, this is occupied land, right? So tanks come in, arrest people. This is, I mean, bombs going off every day, people who's have lost their fathers, their brothers have been arrested, their son is killed. I mean, it's people living with kind of a constant state of trauma. And so my work was working both with young people and with organizations, Palestinian organizations already in the West Bank, who were working on theater as an intervention, kind of the state of human emergency. So how you work with theater and unburdening from violence, how you work with theater and trauma. So I worked a lot with kids and a lot actually with adults as well, and a lot of collaborating with both Israeli and Palestinian and international activists and human rights workers, and actually a lot of people that were there from different spiritual communities as well, kind of trying to do something, not only to witness what's going on, because again, we don't see, right? And we always hear, I think, one side of the story all the time that we kind of eat every morning for breakfast when we hear mainstream media and mainstream news. So part of my work, I think, was seeing and witnessing. But part of the work was giving any little bit I could give. The immense, immense kind of cycle of trauma and cycle of suffering for people. And then, so I'm going to give an overview and then talk about my expectations versus realities. And so then I actually returned from the West Bank. And did probably the craziest, most unhealthy thing I could possibly do, that I think was the best thing I also could possibly do. And I went right to the U.S.-Mexico border in Tucson, Arizona. I was home for a week, right up the street. And then I worked with a small little organization. It's a human rights organization on the U.S.-Mexico border in Tucson, Arizona. And what's happening along the U.S.-Mexico border right now, we know with this immigration crisis, we hear about it all the time, kind of the rhetoric about it, but as a wall is being constructed right along the U.S.-Mexico border, migrants are actually being funneled right into the desert. And so what's happening is people are crossing in these places where it's hard to even survive in crossing. So in Arizona, where I was in Tucson, this is where the most people are coming through. And when we talk about militarization of the border, it's not just the actual physical border, like huge literal walls going up, right? And lights and cameras and border patrol agents and drones and, I mean, like really, really intense militarization, but it's also what's happening in the community. So this means that any person who's Latino, any person of color, any person, even people that have been there generations and generations, there's a First Nation, so an indigenous Native American nation there that's both on the U.S. side and the Mexican side of the border, that's their tribal lands. And the wall actually goes right through their land. And so even to cross back and forth, helicopters watch them. This one woman, her name was Orphelia, and she talks about how she couldn't even, she says, this is my land. I'm from this land. Like, my ancestors are buried here. So, you know, tribal grounds being disrupted, all this kind of stuff. But her being marked as also suspect and outside and, you know, this fear. So my work there was working. I worked a lot with a human rights clinic. So it was people that came in that in the crossing didn't know where their brother was. Had gotten separated. There'd be pregnant women who didn't seek medical attention because they didn't have their papers. They weren't documented. A lot of worker abuse cases all the time. I mean, we know this, right? So, I mean, it's the same in Madison, but people that are undocumented and so aren't going to be able to petition for their rights in the same way and get exploited in the workplace, haven't gotten paid for months. I mean, so these kind of everyday ways, kind of in the failure of these systems, but also how people's bodies are marked with violence. And I'll talk more about Palestine in a moment, but for me, the intensity of also seeing, coming from a place where my body, coming from the West Bank, right away, where my body as a you know, American citizen, as a white person, as an able-bodied person, you know, all these ways have been marked as worthy, as something that wasn't just fodder. And then going again to the U.S.-Mexico border, where again, as a white person, as a citizen, being stopped at checkpoints. You're stopped in checkpoints on the interstate along in the Southwest, and you're asked for your papers. I mean, these things I thought, I was like, how can this even be happening? You know, I study this stuff, I know it academically. But then seeing it, and seeing these parallels, and these growing parallels between two places where people are policed, where people are seen as other. This is the language we always hear about Palestinians, you know, as terrorist, and so that we don't see. And then this language of illegal, and how this language kind of works together, but also that these walls, the 30-foot concrete barrier, fence, it's actually called a fence in Israel and Palestine, so it's a 30-foot concrete fence, if you can imagine. Yeah, it's a fence, but that kind of thing. But that's called a fence, and that's used and actually encloses a people. So we see this, and then we see that there are actually the same companies are building both of these walls, and it's literally the money is the same in both of these places. And these are kind of people in the everyday, right? It's people on the U.S.-Mexico border who are trying to feed their families, trying to get basic services, and then people that are just in the West Bank trying to, you know, get to their olive trees and their grove and, you know, harvest things for their families. So those were the places I was in. And then out of that, bringing to my work out of that, the thing that struck me so much were people's stories, and going back to my own childhood and sharing my personal story, but how much, you know, we can read a book, right? And we can read about the, you know, the wall is being built and this kind of, it's this many, you know, this much money goes into it, or these policies or these laws created it, or the, you know, 1967, 48, this is what happened. But to really hear people's stories and really see the reality. And I think we talk about sometimes these extraordinary violences of war, which are so important to talk about. But one of my experiences was kind of these everyday violences. I mean, people like us, right, who kind of in everyday life, I think we're all extraordinary too, by the way, not to say, oh, we're all just ordinary. But I think actually that is what's extraordinary. Is our everyday stories, the stories of raising kids, of baking bread, you know, of finding little ways to resist, of finding ways to remain human. And that's, to me, what's so powerful. And so in creating this work and creating this story, I felt like, for me as a person, as an outsider in many ways, to be have the privilege of people sharing their stories with me, of people inviting me in, giving me tea, giving me coffee, and talking. Letting me into some of these stories of horror, but also these stories of triumph of their grandkids, for example. How could I then not create space for these stories when these are voices we really can't hear? There's this one young boy, it's actually a line I use in the play, and he said, a young Palestinian boy who's in one of my classes, and he said, how could, you know, he said, well, we could scream, we could beg, we could plead, we could pray, we could do whatever. It doesn't matter. He says, one must have ears to hear. And it hit me, and I thought of, exactly, there's people, I mean, every day, and one thing I think we don't see in the West Bank particularly, and I don't think we see among migrants from Latin America either. But people every day organizing. Every day, people, you know, protesting, people finding different ways to replant, finding ways to stand in solidarity, finding ways to create something nonviolently as well. And so to not share, I guess not share those stories, I felt great responsibility in making space for those. So out of that, me as a, you know, maybe an artist, as an activist, it felt necessary and essential to me to make space for these stories. So then, reality versus, this is one thing I thought, this is a really good question that was posed, and I want to turn it over to all of you in a moment. So the question kind of was, what was the reality like on the ground versus what I had anticipated going in? And I think that's so good, because I think for me, even in my academic studies and this kind of stuff, and intellectually, I knew what was happening. I knew this wall was being built. I knew kind of the history. I knew, you know, the history of Zionism, the history of Palestinian nationalism, you know, the complicated story. And I always talked about with people, it's so complicated. You know, it's very complicated. And that was almost a way, I think, a word that I used to almost not have to be able to say a critique, but then be like, oh, it's so complicated. And then when I was on the ground, it felt suddenly not complicated. It was a really interesting thing to me, because it was so much worse. For example, the occupation was so much worse than I could even imagine. I'll give you an example. It was people constantly waiting in checkpoints, constantly waiting. In the city of Nablus I worked in, it's about the size of Madison, the city itself. 250,000, something like that, right? Madison, I don't know, something. It's about that size. And there's a large university there. It's really beautiful. It's in these mountains. Lovely, lovely place. And marketplaces, just really, really quite beautiful. But all around the city, there's actually 17 different checkpoints. And men between the ages of 15 and 35 are absolutely not allowed to leave the city at all. And people, you have to apply for permits and wait for permits, and they might get there, they might not. Constantly, as I say, constantly incursions, constantly, this city is seen as kind of this hotbed of resistance. So what does that mean, right? So it's, you know, there may have been at one point armed resistance, but there's also, I mean, that's, you don't see Palestinians aren't allowed to have guns. So it's kind of an interesting thing of who you see actually carrying guns are the soldiers. And you see university students like this friend I had, Ashraf, who's actually a musician. And he kept trying to get to his university classes in a town that was nearby. And as he tried to get to his university classes, he couldn't, he was going to miss his exams, not make it. And he knew this way to get over the hills to get there. And he speaks English, I mean, very, very educated, kind of a privileged family. So he decided to cross over the hills to get there. And he got shot in his leg. And while he was, shot in your leg is a horrible, horrible thing, but it's also something a hospital can deal with. You can do something about it. As he waits in the checkpoint line, they wouldn't let him through to get to the ambulance, to get to the hospital, and so he ended up, his leg is permanently, permanently damaged, and he's not even able now to make it to his classes. So it's kind of this idea, if you think about Palestinian people, are actually the ethnic group in our world that had the highest rate of PhHDs of anyone. So it's like, shocking if you think of like challenging all our bias and myth, but it's so many people who are so educated, and education almost for what? Because people say there is no out. It feels really hopeless. So the reality felt so much worse and so much more crushing than I could even imagine. I think we just saw, I don't know if any of you saw, but I felt like something that broke through in our mainstream media that was really big was everything happening in Gaza and kind of the big bombs going off and the carnage of children. I mean, really, really horrifying suffering. And for me, what was so interesting is this everyday violence happening in the West Bank that is almost slowly deactivating a people. So it's everything from settlers throwing stones and children on their way to school to a hospital being the place that is destroyed, to people actually not being able to have access to their well water because Israel owns all the, has access to all the water and they have to buy it back. That's part of, you know, the occupation. They wouldn't have control over their own resources in that way. So the everyday violences. I'm actually looking. I'm not doing anything. If you have any questions at any point, I'm bad at staying with time. So if you have any questions at any point, you can also jump in. Please really do. So for me, one thing that was complicated in the reality for me, I've been taught in working with nonviolence work and working with unburdening from trauma to kind of transform violence, right? Going into like the place of conflict, working on conflict resolution, working on interrupting something. And so I think I came in with this mindset with young people that I was going to, I mean, it's a very kind of imperialist thing, really, but this idea of I came in and I was going to somehow be able to work with young people to imagine beyond this reality that was so crushing. And the thing for me that I got hit with was to pretend in some way that we weren't in a bullet-riddled classroom, that there was an incursion going on, that the streets weren't literally in fire outside, would have been a denial also of these young people's reality. And what they needed almost was to obsessively, in some ways, perform the violence they saw in their everyday lives. I wrote this one piece back home, and I was sharing with my parents. I said I saw 3 funerals and a wedding, you know, without ever having to leave this cement classroom today. And the children can, you know, pantomime the bullet's exact point of entry. I talked about how they know the Arabic death chant better than the birthday song. You know, this is what they eat every day for breakfast. It's kids who swallow knives, but still in that, and in showing up to class, and in being eager to work with it, I think that is still hopeful, if that makes sense. There was this one day that was really painful for me, and it was one of my last classes in a specific city, and the kids, you know, were eager, and they were there and showing up. And these are kids, this one camp particularly, who usually don't sleep through the night, who have constant urinary problems. It's, you know, the realities of war, it's scary, and there's a lot of trauma all the time. And children who came in and showed up to class, and it was clear I had to cancel class because there was going to be curfew that night. They needed to leave, and there was one young boy I remember particularly, had a necklace that had 5 little pictures on it. I remember thinking I didn't even have to ask, that I knew all these young kids were dead. So that kind of intent, you know, that kind of what you live with, that ghosts are right there, and to pretend that they're not right there, does that make sense? Would have been not fair, I think, to the young people, but also not honoring of where they're at. But then, at the same time, to not allow opportunities for them to laugh, too. And to imagine, even for a moment, you know, that there's the ocean there. So many of the families in the camps are from coastal villages that are now in Israel right now, because a lot of them are refugees. So during the Nakba, so 60 years ago, and also the creation of the State of Israel, so many families, I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands of people were displaced. And a lot of them were from very agricultural areas and places exactly that were fishing villages. So actually on the walls of these concrete camps, you see pictures everywhere of boats and of ships. And kind of, I almost think of them as wielding memory, you know, these cement walls, which is really fascinating. But anyways, and so I'm going through this camp, and I had this reality versus, I think somewhere in me I still had this, you know, this is scary, there you should have some fear, which I think is really important to have too. To be conscious and be aware of where you are, and, you know, thinking of my parents and this kind of stuff. But as I walked through this camp, it was the first time I'd ever really felt fear, and I thought, you know, I'm somewhere, I'm an American, right? I am complicit in this. This is literally my money that is making this happen. These are my M16s, like this is all me. I'm blonde, right? I'm white, I'm in this space, I speak very little Arabic, I'm here, what am I doing? And this one boy kept leading me farther and farther into the camp. So all my prejudice that I probably ingested somewhere and put away, you know, somewhere else, and that I felt like I'd worked through, but probably was all coming up. And I led around, and he brings me into this back alleyway. And he's pulling something out. So he turns his back, he's pulling something out. And in his hand, he pulls, and I'm actually like scared at this point. In his hand, he pulls out and he holds up to me, and it's a kitten, like this little baby kitten. And I thought, soul, like, what is your problem? You know, get with it. How do you have a right to have fear this life? Like, look at this beauty in here. My experience again and again on the U.S.-Mexico border and in Israel and Palestine was this idea of absolutely, we want you to see. We want you to hear. We want to share these stories. We can't get them out anywhere else. Please carry this. Please talk to people. You know, this is our lives. This one experience that was really interesting to me, too, I think we always hear this. I was kind of sure, because you think of an occupation, just like within the United States, I think it's hard in our country. Well, it's been hard. It was hard under Bush, at least, to separate Saddam Hussein, for example, from the Iraqi people, right? That separation couldn't be made. And so I think I had this belief, too, that it would be the same about Israelis, that the Palestinians would have a lot of, I think, well-deserved anger and, you know, this is occupation, how can this be happening? And the thing that was really incredible to me, and actually I think really challenged me in my own thinking and how I even make people as enemy and as other, was this sense of, oh, it's their government. It's not the people. We know, like, our government's corrupt, your government's corrupt, all governments. It's not the people. And so this sense, again, on the U.S.-Mexico border of, there's this one woman, this story in a play, and she talks about that she's a nanny, and she takes care of this woman's kids in Phoenix. And she says, I take care of her kids while she's at work. She's a criminal lawyer. While she's at work making money prosecuting my kids. So we're all part of this kind of system, you know. There's another woman, a Palestinian doctor, or she's studying to be a doctor. She's a medical student. And she shared with me, and there's actually this monologue out of it. I'm plugging the show. You should all come and see it. And there's a story of a woman, and she talks about this interconnected, almost cycle. She says, you know, I will remove the bullets that you put in the backs of my brothers. She says, without you, I really have no job. And she says, without me, you have no job. And she's like, and so then when you've run out of bullets, you know, we'll be all stitched up, you know, and then what will we do? And they're looking at each other. So you see this system. And so the thing for me is, I think here in the United States, this is reality versus, or I guess, does that make sense? On the ground reality versus imagined reality. There's always a sense to me of two-state solution makes sense. You know, peace is possible, all these kind of things, which I still, parts of that I still believe. But there's a sense on the ground of how sustainable the occupation is, if that makes sense. We think of right now, under Obama, actually, on the U.S.-Mexico border, he's just been talking about increased surveillance and increased militarization and a new thing right now where they're actually taking along the Rio Grande, they're taking, killing all the shrubs along. I mean, just insane. Insane stuff in my mind that's not actually looking at kind of the economic policies that cause migration. But how to not see that one state, for example, in Israel and Palestine, is actually functioning right now. There aren't two states, really. That the wall and its snaking and cutting land and taking water, that to even talk about autonomy and even talk about two viable states of people living in peace, that the occupation would need to end. And talking about, even with so many different Israeli activists, and saying, please, please stop funding this. You know, this isn't making us safer. This isn't making our lives any better. Just incredible, and incredible, vibrant movements that I think have been so silenced in the United States of Israeli activists. I have two good friends actually at school. One of my friends, he's a refusenik, an Israeli refusenik, so it's people that refuse to, you know, military service is required. It's people that refuse to serve in the army. And he talks about that, you know, always we don't want to criticize Israel. He says, you need to. We need to be critiquing U.S. policy. We need to be critiquing this because these are people's lives. And he served for 2 years in solitary confinement for refusing to serve in the army. And his thing was, these are his neighbors. How can he, you know, have his foot on the neck of his neighbor? So with that, I want to turn it over to a few moments for questions. And any questions you may have, thoughts, concerns?
Yeah. Imagine that you're a senior, so what comes next?
I don't know. Good question. I really, for me, I would love to be involved in activism in a broader sense, but in also looking at art and further ways in working in communities of art. So I don't know exactly is my answer. I hope.
We're trying to put it on tape. So.
Oh, great.
I really appreciated what you said. I don't mean to challenge your experience, but the PhDs, tell me that again, that the Palestinians have...
It's a good question. Actually, interestingly, two-thirds of the Palestinian population live outside of the West Bank and Gaza, if that makes sense. And it's a population of people that actually, I think if you think of different groups and different ethnic groups, it's a really good question, because I think it was crazy to me when I found this out. But there's a sense of education as really being a form of resistance, if that makes sense. So to have a really educated population, we're capable of resisting more. So one of the things I saw, regardless of class background and all these kind of things, was study. You know, kids study, do this kind of thing. And I thought, for me, and growing up in a lesbian parented family, I know one of the things, interestingly enough, was always going out and looking presentable too, and being respectful to people. So I think when you're, my sense would be, in my interpretation of this, would be in knowing that you're made other by the world and you're not seen, that through your education, through learning about your situation, through these kind of things, actually, if you think of so many top professors in the United States actually are Palestinian, and a lot of people we don't know of as Palestinian, and a lot of people throughout Europe, but there's also many, many colleges and universities in the West Bank and in Gaza. So in Berzeit University, which is a really famous university, is in Ramallah. There's An-Najah University, there's the American University of Palestine. So there's actually a number of universities. And that was one of the things that's really fascinating about what happened recently in Gaza, is there was four or five universities, great universities apparently, really great universities, that they were the first places that were actually blown up and destroyed. And a lot of them were housing people in hiding. Not just UNs, there's a lot of UN schools as well, but there's also, there's also people that have been living in the West Bank for forever. I think it is really interesting. I think it's a shocking thing, also because of how, at least in my mind, how I had images painted for me of who the Palestinian people were. But looking at, there's a huge rural community, but there's also huge urban, vibrant communities. If you look at Edward Said, I don't know if you know Edward Said, wrote Orientalism, really famous in these ways. He's Palestinian and grew up in Jerusalem and then in Egypt. When his family was exiled. And he talks about how that was always such a huge thing, education.
And I don't know if this is true for there, but it seems like a lot of countries outside the United States, and more developed ones, that education is more accessible.
Exactly.
So you don't have to pay out to the nose for all the education.
Exactly.
The United States has to pay.
Exactly.
I guess I was just wondering, being in Palestine, how can you keep your hopes up, I guess?
That's a really good question. I spoke at this high school class a couple weeks ago, and the kids were studying about kind of U.S. I shouldn't call kids, I'm very near in age. Young people studying about the U.S. or U.S.-Mexico border and Israel and Palestine, and we're like, actually, we see no prospect of peace. This seems entirely hopeless to us. And I was thinking, how can you be hopeless? We are, right? We're the young ones. And I thought of how could I, when I had the privilege of movement, when I had the privilege to also lead, not hold some hope. Does that make sense? And so I don't know if it's exactly hope, but it was a sense of the child with the kitten, right? Or young people I worked with who wore clown noses and played with their families. It was oftentimes old men and old women who would sit around and tell stories and still held kind of those memories that they would not let be erased. Does that make sense? Or as people that still made food, as people that in waiting at checkpoints tell stories, and make jokes and keep life going. So for me, there was incredible sense. There's one actually monologue in the piece, another plug for the show, but a monologue in the piece that's a Palestinian Muslim woman, and she talks about it's always the women who are to blame. She says, it's always the women who are to blame for our oppression and yours. And she talks about the hijab, so the headscarf. She says, you know, you always talk about the headscarf as the source of my suffering, these kind of things. Islam is the enemy of peace and not the tanks. But she also says, look at this. She says, look, she says, Gandhi has nothing on us. She says, look, see all that our hands don't do? So she's kind of talking about all the ways people are resisting, all the ways she talks about being like a bird, a sununu bird. It's a bird that always patches, always mends, always continues. So to me, the thing that was profoundly hopeful is people, even in the most impossible of situations, remaining human and keeping humanity and refusing to make people, and I don't think everyone does this, but I think refusing to make anyone other. Do you know what I mean? So keeping dignity in that way. And I saw it hugely among migrants, too. There was this really horrible thing, and it's called Operation Streamline. And it's this way of when a migrant is arrested in crossing the border, they're actually shackled together, both in legs and in hands and in these big lines. And then they're prosecuted together and kind of held in these like pens, really, in open air, you know, in the hot sun. And it was the way in which people still were dignified and refused to have that stripped. Do you know what I mean? So to me, I think that is profoundly, to me, that's hopeful. So kind of the amazing human capacities in the middle of some of the worst things I think us human beings do to each other.
What was the name of the group in Tucson that you were working
with? I worked with, it's called Coalición de Derechos Humanos. It's called, in English, it's the Human Rights Coalition.
Okay, so that was the name of the group in Tucson.
That's the name of the group in Tucson.
Were you familiar also with a group, I think it's No More Deaths?
I was, and they do amazing work.
Yeah, I'm going to talk to you afterwards about that, because I have a connection with them.
Oh, great, wonderful. And No More Deaths, just to say, they do incredible aid to people in the desert who are crossing, kind of in providing humanitarian aid, water.
I like your enthusiasm.
Thank you. Thank you. I think one thing with the hope that came again and again is that it really is up to us. I think of one thing that's been discouraging. I think getting Obama elected was so hopeful and such a change. And then I think at the same time there's so much farther to go. And looking at his policies about a lot of these two issues specifically is really horrifying to me. But I think that we also, as people, have the power, and we have such access here. And I think I can feel so small here sometimes in affecting this change, but seeing how much more access I have, does that make sense? How can we not? So this play, for example, I'll plug it. I have some flyers that you should take. It runs. I'm going to plug it for real. It runs actually this afternoon. You could come at 2 o'clock, and there's a talk back. Session afterwards to talk with people. And then one more weekend. This next weekend on Friday, Saturday, night at 8 o'clock, and Sunday at 2 p.m. And it's on Williamson Street. It's called Broom Street Theater. If you know where Mother Fool's Coffee House is, or the Willie Street Co-op, it's between those places. So it's on Williamson and Ingersoll, kind of that little tiny black box theater. So 8 o'clock and 2 p.m. on Sundays. But one of the things with doing that is art is something, these conversations are something, but it's also talking to people. The thing that was biggest to me is it's breaking the silence and my own fear, I think, of talking about these things, of challenging, of saying, when someone says, oh, yeah, they're just coming, taking our jobs, this kind of thing, of thinking, you know, talking to my grandmother, you know, challenging the beliefs, in, you know, obviously a very respectful way, but talking about that and what is behind that. And what is that fear from, and where do we get that from? You know what I mean? And talking about, actually, you know, I think talking about what does occupation actually mean? What does it mean to be building a wall? So kind of opening up, does that make sense? Refusing to be silent, I think, about these injustices in all these different places in our world, and that these processes of making someone other, of racializing someone as other, of deeming someone's body as not worthy, that's not rare to these two locations. You know, that happens everywhere. We see it in Afghanistan right now. We see it in Iraq. We see it even, you know, in our neighborhood.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.